From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Dale Throneberry.
Good morning and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Throneberry and I'll be your host this morning. And joining me in the studio is my cohort in crime, Bob Gould. Good morning, Bob.
Hoo-ah!
Oh, boy, he's ready to go. It's early in the morning here.
We're
on
here.
The East Coast.
We're ready.
I know those on the West Coast are even more or less awake than we are.
That opened their eyes.
Well, it opened mine. Thank you very much. I needed that.
That could have been the onion bagel, too, you know.
Today we're really excited about the program that I've got going on today. We're going to be talking about Dwight Eisenhower, one of my personal heroes. And we've got an author of a new biography, John Wolkowitz, is going to be on. And also we've got Dan Holt, who is the director of the Eisenhower Library and Museum, will be on in a little while. And we're going to be talking about Ike. And everybody liked Ike when we were growing up, and all of us that are in
that was a great slogan, wasn't it?
Well, it worked. It's funny, when I sent out the flyer for the program, I got an email from a veteran from Jackson, and he said that, you know, I met Ike in 1952 when he was campaigning in Jackson, and he says, my current wife, she shook hands with him. And they were so excited by that because he said he was 6 or 7 years old. And he said he had a little pin at the time that you would press, and it would say, you know, you'd press it and go, I like Ike. And it was very effective.
I think that was the first presidential campaign that had real marketing with the emphasis on I like Ike.
It
actually had a theme.
Well, it was one of the first ones with slogans, but, I mean, you go back to... You can go back almost all to the beginning.
Oh, right.
When they
got
little pins.
But this was they had television. They didn't have it back in the 40s.
Eisenhower was the first president.
Real TV,
that TV
president.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, and all the photography and this stuff of Stevenson with the shoe with a hole in it and all these other things that were out there at the time.
Oh, that wasn't contrived, of course not.
Oh, no. Didn't say that. No. He was on the road all the time. But anyway, so we're going to be having John and Dan. Dan will be on in about 5 or 6 minutes, but first we're going to go to the news, and Bob, it's all in your court.
Thank you, Dale. Welcome to Veterans Radio News. The VA is searching for lost soldiers from World War I. With only 4 living American veterans of World War I currently known, the Department of Veterans Affairs, of course, that's the VA, is seeking public assistance in determining whether others are still around, still alive. To qualify as a World War I veteran, someone must have been on active duty between April 6th, 1917, and November 11th, 1918. If you happen to know of someone or even think of someone that might be that, have them contact the local VA.
In fact, they just had the oldest living woman veteran just died from World War I. I believe she was 108. And they didn't even really know she was a veteran of World War I up until just shortly before she died.
So was she in the Army?
She was a WAC.
She was a WAC. Okay.
Ambulance driver.
Right, yeah, okay. An organization provides troops prepaid calling cards. TNT announced last week that it's providing the nonprofit organization Cell Phones for Soldiers with 10,000 prepaid calling cards. That's valued at nearly $270,000. For those who would like to donate a cell phone, this company has designated singular stores in all cities as drop-off points. Or, for more information, at singular stores, if you have a cell phone that you want to donate, contact the singular cellular phone company. Right, yeah, organization. The group collects cell phones, this is Cell Phones for Soldiers, and recycles them for cash. The cash is then used to buy prepaid calling cards for servicemen. What a great, that's terrific. Right, they can call home.
Right.
Right,
yes,
exactly.
I mean, that's great that they're able to call home.
Call home, That keeps morale up.
Yep.
Indiana license plates aids troops' families. The state of Indiana has delivered its first payment to the new Indiana Military Family Relief Fund. That fund makes $2,000 grants available to eligible families of Indiana soldiers who have been called to active duty. Grants are financed by the sale of 2 specialty license plates. That's $20 for each one. I believe that's in lieu of the regular rights, like a little. And it says on there, support our troops. And there is another one for $15 called Hoosier Veteran. Those are tags that are going on their license plates.
Hoosier.
Hoosier. What did I say?
Hoosier.
Well, I'm not from there.
Who's from Indiana?
I'm from Michigan.
Hoosiers are from Indiana.
Yeah, right. We say what? Okay. One requirement for the award is that servicemen must have suffered a loss in pay, have incurred a significant increase in the necessities of daily living, or have suffered a significant emergency that warrants financial assistance. Real quick, the Predator drone is phased out for a new well-armed craft. What do you know about that, Dale?
Right, yeah. The Predator that everybody knows is being used in Afghanistan and Iraq right now is not necessarily being phased out, but there's a new additional member of the family, and it's called the Reaper. And the Reaper can fly higher, faster, longer, and it can carry a 3,000-pound payload. And so, you know, there's an issue.
I think it has Hellfire missiles on it, too.
I don't know, but we'll find out
time. Absolutely.
And now we're going to go into our Welcome Home segment.
Okay, Welcome Home. Each week on Veterans Radio, we welcome home servicemen and women who have been stationed around the world in the service of our country. Welcome Home segment is sponsored by the Marine Scholars Program of Ave Maria University. You can visit them online at avemaria.edu or call Aaron Flaherty.
Flaherty.
Yeah, that's a good Irish name. Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. That's 239-280-2552. Soldiers from the Alpha 163rd Support Battalion of the 218th Enhanced Separate Brigade National Guard Unit returned home from training at the Waterboro National Guard Armory in Waterboro, South Carolina. They will be deployed to Afghanistan. Nearly 100 friends and family welcomed home Army soldier Travis Freeburn in Saugus, California last Saturday. He sustained a concussion from a roadside bomb near Mosul, Iraq. Bless you, Travis. A Welcome Home Warrior Citizen program was held for 51 Army Reserve officers and soldiers on April 14th in Conroe, Texas. A solemn note, there was a ceremony held on Wednesday, April 18th at CFB Trenton, Ontario, Canada, as the remains of 6 soldiers were returned home. The men were killed when a roadside bomb struck the vehicle west of Kandahar. We at Veterans Radio salute our fallen brothers from our northern neighbor.
Okay.
That's it.
Thank
Dan.
You very much.
You're
and
welcome.
We'll be back right after these messages. And we are back on Veterans Radio, and we're going to be talking with our guests here in just a moment, the author of Eisenhower, a biography, part of the Great General series, and that's John Wolkowitz. The foreword is done by General Wesley Clark, and I'm hoping that John is on the line. And John, welcome to Veterans Radio. No, he's not on the line right this second, so we'll just talk about Ike a little bit.
Let's talk about Ike.
All right. Well,
he had to be a politician first before he was a general. He had to prove that he could work with politics. That really what this was all about.
I think the issue, yeah, well,
because there were so many egos and.
Okay, now we've got John on the line.
Oh, we do. Okay.
And John Wolkowitz, welcome to Veterans Radio. Not yet. John? Okay. We'll keep on going here. Oh, they're pressing buttons all over the place in there, in the control room. So we'll be talking with John in just a moment, I hope. John, you there? I don't hear John. But meantime.
Eisenhower had to be the man of the hour.
Well, he had to, based on the timing of everything. I mean, he was born out in the middle of Kansas.
He had the great.
Actually born in Texas.
Right. I mean, it could have been the. And you couldn't have wrote a better description of an American hero. Values and.
Well, the thing that I've always found interesting about Eisenhower was that he was, you know, he wasn't the most intelligent person, you know, out there as far as military was concerned. And
right.
He spent a lot of time, you know, being an underling to famous people. I mean, like MacArthur and Marshall and some of the other generals that were there. And when he went to West Point, the only reason he went to West Point was because it was free, and his only opportunity he had to go to college. Plus, at that point, you know, West Point was a big football school, and he was a big football player, a big excellent athlete in all sports. And so he went there, but like I think it was the first week or two at West Point, he blew his knee out. And so he was done. And he didn't graduate at the top of his class, and he didn't graduate at the bottom of his class. He was just, you know, one of the things about Eisenhower that I've always admired was that he seemed like a grandfather to our generation. And he seemed like just a good old boy. And he worked hard. He stayed in the military after World War I. He didn't get to go to combat in World War I. He was a trainer and an organizer and logistics and all those other things, and those were his real skills.
I think that's why he was picked for Normandy.
I think eventually he was. Can we try now? Okay, John, are you there? Is anybody there?
Yeah, Dan's still here.
Hi, Dan. I'll talk to you then while we're waiting for the other call. How are you, Dan?
Fine.
Right now we're talking with Dan Holt, who is the director of the Eisenhower Library and Museum out in, where are you?
Abilene,
Kansas. That's right.
I've been there.
Yes.
Actually, you know, Abilene, Texas is named for Abilene, Kansas.
Well, you know, somebody had to go through Kansas to get to Texas, I guess.
That's right.
Well, I want to welcome you to Veterans Radio, and I apologize for the technical problems, but we'll get those squared away. What can you tell me about Ike? You heard us talking probably a little bit about what we know.
Well, I didn't hear very much. I think it's important with Eisenhower, and everybody overlooks it, you have to study the interwar years.
Right.
Between World War I and World War II.
That's
because, actually, Eisenhower, when he was with the Assistant Secretary of War, the Chief of Staff, and in the Philippines, is the most important formative period of his career. You know, things like he was already writing about the military-industrial complex in 1930.
Right, yeah, I do understand
that. The War Policies Commission.
Mm-hmm.
That plus he was involved with the groups, quote-unquote, within the military that was rewriting the structure of the military, especially in mobilization in case of war and, you know, the outlooks on training. And Eisenhower was what some people now classify as the intelligentsia in that time period because people were just training for exercises, not training for real war. Eisenhower understood that, but the Philippines is the most important period pre-World War II. You know, he had to build an army from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
The administration, Roosevelt administration, really didn't care if we got a defense force built in the Philippines. And he was sitting out there with a very difficult MacArthur and having to beg for arms, ammunition. Was responsible for everything. He even designed the barracks. He wrote all the military laws for the Philippine Army with one assistant. And it's a remarkable, remarkable job he did, and it's just too often overlooked.
Yeah, I think that's very important. Joining us on the line right now, hopefully, is John Wolkowitz. John, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Hi, John. Welcome to Veterans Radio. And
thank you for having me on.
It's our pleasure. And as you can hear, we're kind of starting to talk a little bit about Eisenhower with mm-hmm. Dan Holt, director of the Eisenhower Library and Museum. I don't know if you know each other, but good morning to both of you.
Well, good morning.
So, John, tell me, I didn't get a chance to do my formal introduction of you, but you are a very, very prolific writer. And not only is military history one of your hobbies, but also sports, Western heroes, everything that I like. I got to meet you in person.
Yeah, it's been fun. You know, I started out my writing career doing magazine articles, newspaper articles, kinds of things. So you get into all sorts of topics. I grew up loving golf, and so I still do a little bit of golf writing. But the focus is now World War II. I've loved reading and writing about World War II, reading it since the time I was probably fifth or sixth grade. I picked up a book on the Battle of the Coral Sea.
Mm-hmm.
And so my focus is 98% on World War II. And thus I have the books on the battles of Wake Island and Tarawa and Eisenhower and Admiral Clifton Sprague.
I saw that. I was going to ask you how you got involved with the Eisenhower, or actually the Great General series.
Well, the publisher contacted me because they'd seen some of my other books and just asked if I'd be interested in writing one. And I said, sure. You know, it's not every day that a publisher comes calling. And, you know, I heard who was involved in it with General Wesley Clark and mm-hmm. some of the other authors, and I thought, well, this is a neat little series. By little, I mean the size of the books are maybe half the size of my normal World War II books, which are maybe 300 pages. The Eisenhower's 150 to 200 pages. And they wanted us, instead of going through Eisenhower's career in an extensive fashion, they wanted us to focus on just his military career and to draw lessons in leadership that anybody could use, you know, how to handle a business, how to handle a classroom, that kind of a thing.
Well, I think it's a great book, as John's pointing out. It's not a big book. It kind of reminds me of those old sports hero books that you used to read in the library, like Lou Gehrig, you know, Iron Man and things. It was about 150 pages. They were orange. I remember them specifically. But tell us a little bit about Eisenhower. Tell us about his upbringing that kind of led him to the military. Could you do that for us?
Sure. His young days were pretty much, as I read about him, I thought, well, you know, a lot like my own. He loved sports. He had his childhood heroes. One of them was Honus Wagner, the great baseball player. Most of them were military and Western figures, because he lived out west, obviously. He especially admired Tom Smith, Marshal of Abilene, Kansas, and would go out and visit his grave site. He roamed the fields with his brothers and was quite popular in school. He wound up at West Point not because he had this great dream of being a huge military figure, but for two reasons. It was a free education, and the taxpayers were footing the bill, and secondly, he wanted to play football. He loved football. That was his passion early in life. The fact that it was at West Point was secondary. He got his free education and he had the chance to play football.
But unfortunately, his football career ended quickly.
Yeah, he had a string of injuries. He overcame a couple of them, one when he was still back in Kansas, and he had a knee injury and sort of fell into a coma, and the doctor was examining him, and he told the family they might have to amputate the knee, the leg, and Eisenhower heard that. Well, when everyone left the room, he beckoned to his brother and said, I want you to promise me you will not let them take my leg. I can't go on if I can't play football. And so they did not, obviously. But then in West Point, he suffered some more injuries and had to leave football. Walked the campus sort of depressed about it, and students started calling him Gloomy Face. He didn't turn his full attention to studies at all. I mean, when he graduated, it was a very unremarkable record that he amassed. For instance, in academics, he was sort of right smack in the middle, and in discipline out of his class, he was right near the bottom of it. So he really wasn't one who applied himself yet. I taught for 30 years in eighth grade.
Oh, you deserve a medal just for that. I did that for six years myself.
I know. That's what everyone says. oh, boy, what about the jungle that you were in? But, you know, if you enjoy that age group, and I did.
That's true.
You have a blast. You know, I look at teachers who teach first graders, and I think, whoa, man, I could never handle that. But if you enjoy your area, your age group, you'll have a lot of fun. And I would, every once in a while, have a student that I would look at, and the student would receive maybe a C or a B minus, and I'd be thinking, you know, you're so smart. I know you just seem to be biding your time until the challenges start to roll at you. And that was Eisenhower. The challenges had not yet occurred. It was football. Now that that's gone, he had to find something else, and eventually he found it when he got it going on his military career.
Well, we're talking with John Wolkowitz, the author of a new biography called Eisenhower. It's not that new anymore. It came out of last fall, I believe.
Yeah, last November.
And also joining us is Dan Holt, who is the director of the Eisenhower Library and Museum. And can either one of you tell us a little bit about after he... He graduated from West Point, what, about 1918, somewhere in that neighborhood, or earlier than that?
No, it was 1916.
1915.
Okay, and then he didn't get to participate in World War I overseas, did he?
No, he was one of those where, and this was maybe the first challenge in his military career, that he missed out on combat quite often. He in World War One he had a few opportunities where he thought he would, but he was always assigned to a training post. He'd even he participated with the 301st Tank Battalion, for instance, and the superiors had sort of promised that that battalion would go overseas and fight, and it did, but they kept him back home to do some more training. And then in late 1918, they said, well, in the spring of 1919, we're going to have a new offensive, and you'll be part of that. Of course, the war ended before that happened. So he looked back on that as sort of one of the down times of his military career. But he, like everyone who succeeds, you sort of take obstacles and turn them into opportunities. And this is where now these challenges started to come his way, and he started to look at his military career in a more serious manner. And he decided, hey, maybe I didn't do that well at West Point. Maybe they saw that. I'm going to start working harder now, and by God, I'll make something out of myself. And, of course, it eventually did happen that way.
So tell us a little bit about his experiences with MacArthur. Once he went from, at the end of World War One, how soon did he go to the Philippines with MacArthur?
Okay, is this for me or Dan?
Either one can jump in. Dan, I'll go to Dan this time.
I'm going to have to get to another phone. I think my battery's getting low. Be right back.
Okay, thank you. All right, then, John, I'll give it to you.
Yeah, I'll take it. He had many experiences with MacArthur before the Philippines even. He worked with him in the early 1930s in Washington, D.C.,
Okay, got me?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, go ahead, Dan.
Well, as I said just before John came on the air, that if you don't study the interwar period of Eisenhower, you don't understand Eisenhower in World War II. And as I mentioned, the Philippines is probably the most important training he had. One anecdote, one of the injuries he had to his leg at West Point that got him out of football was dismounting his horse, which everybody gets a kick out of. But on the other side of that, Eisenhower didn't quit. He didn't mope around. He became cheerleader. You know, so here's a man who had lost the one love he had, but he turned right around and helped support the team. So just little anecdotes about his character. But when you look at his work with the War Policies Commission, writing everything almost for the Secretary of War and Assistant Secretary of War speeches, and the revamping of the Army during that time period, and then facing MacArthur in the Philippines, where he actually built an army from nothing out there and had to deal with very, very difficult social structure, almost a foreign head of state in Quezon, who, as you remember, fought against us in the Philippine insurrection and would have done it again if he could have found a way to do it. So here's Eisenhower stuck between MacArthur and Quezon, and it got so bad on occasion that Quezon would invite Eisenhower to the palace to find out what MacArthur was doing.
Oh.
Now, here's a man who was stuck in the middle of a very diplomatic situation. And I've often said when he goes to England in 42, has to deal with the Brits, somewhat with the French, and a group of American military commanders who really weren't up to snuff yet, he was child's play. He'd been through this.
I was going to say, the other story that we know about Eisenhower being stuck in the middle was with the Veterans March on Washington in the early 1930s.
Yeah, he wrote MacArthur's report for MacArthur and tried to make MacArthur sound as good as he could. And you find this all the way through. He was literally writing all the Assistant Secretary of War speeches. He was meeting with people like Bernard Baruch on almost a weekly basis, a major. I became convinced when we were editing his pre-war diaries and papers that any time they wanted anything done in the War Department, they just gave it to Eisenhower.
Huh. This is an image that most of us don't have of him.
Very smart man and an excellent writer.
It sounds like it. So we've got Eisenhower working under MacArthur here, is he a lieutenant colonel or colonel yet?
Well, it depends. He's got a whole slew of temporary ranks, and if it's too hard for most people to sort this out because they don't understand temporary ranks and then the permanent ranks. And he goes through that time period from he might be a major, and then he might be a lieutenant colonel, and he's back to major, and then he's colonel, and then he's back to major again, then he gets his permanent ranks, and that's just too complicated to really go into. But basically, most of that time, he was a major.
I guess the point I was trying to make is that in today's military, you don't normally spend 20, 25 years to get to be a major.
Yeah, you got to remember, when he's in the Philippines, he comes back, he's a 51-year-old permanent lieutenant colonel with no future, basically,
wow.
Until the war breaks out.
Mm-hmm. So did he, John, I'm going back to you. John, did he contemplate retiring at any point?
Well, very early, but nothing serious. In the 1930s, he had a couple of quite lucrative financial offers to leave the military. One from publisher William Randolph Hearst, who asked him to be the newspaper chain's top military correspondent, and he turned that down. And his second from a citizens group in Manila. He decided, no, the Army is where I want to stay. Eventually the country will be involved in a conflict, and I want to be part of that. He had studied quite a bit in the 20s under a man who was his mentor, General Fox Connor, and Connor always emphasized, you know, maybe in 20 years, whatever, there'll be another clash, and you'll have to know how to work with allies, and so Eisenhower was trying to prepare for that. And that's why his service with MacArthur was so valuable for Eisenhower in writing all these reports and in dealing with the numerous politicians who came through MacArthur's offices when they were in Washington, D.C. Eisenhower received excellent training in how to handle people and in how to present complicated information in somewhat of a simple fashion, in a clear fashion. So it was quite a good experience for him.
I've got a little bit less than a minute till we come up to our next break. Can you tell us a little bit, just a quick story about his where he was at the beginning of World War II?
Yeah. Okay. Dan. Oh, me?
I'm sorry.
I'll tell you one thing you need to look at on that. He's at Fort Sam, and he was asked to give the graduation speech to the air cadets at Kelly Field. And he was invited to do that in November, and he sits down and writes the speech. And then after Pearl Harbor, he rewrites the speech, and it's one of the most inspiring, inspirational things you'll ever read. And it was never given.
Oh.
And if you really want to take a look at the real Eisenhower, that's the speech you need to look at right before the war. And then, of course, he was summoned to the war.
We got to go. We'll be right back after this. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Corporal Larry Maxim, despite numerous severe wounds, continued to defend his position for an hour and a half. Details after this. Maxim was serving as a fire team leader in Vietnam when the district headquarters came under extremely heavy rocket, artillery, mortar, and recoilless rifle fire from a numerically superior enemy force, destroying a portion of the defensive perimeter. Maxim, observing the enemy massing for an assault into the compound across the remaining defensive wire, instructed his assistant fire team leader to take charge of the fire team and unhesitatingly proceeded to the weakened section of the perimeter. Completely exposed to the concentrated enemy fire, he sustained multiple fragmentation wounds from exploding grenades as he ran to an abandoned machine gun position. Reaching the emplacement, he grasped the machine gun and commenced to deliver effective fire on the advancing enemy. As the enemy directed maximum firepower against the determined Marine, Maxim's position received a direct hit from a rocket-propelled grenade, knocking him backwards and inflicting severe fragmentation wounds to his face and right eye. Although momentarily stunned and in intense pain, Maxim courageously resumed his firing position and subsequently was struck again by small arms fire. With resolute determination, he gallantly continued to deliver intense machine gun fire, causing the enemy to retreat through the defensive wire to positions of cover. In a desperate attempt to silence his weapon, the North Vietnamese threw hand grenades and directed recoilless rifle fire against him, inflicting two additional wounds. Too weak to reload his machine gun, Maxim fell to a prone position and valiantly continued to deliver effective fire with his rifle. After 1.5 hours, during which he was hit repeatedly by fragments from exploding grenades and concentrated small arms fire, he succumbed to his wounds, having successfully defended nearly half of the perimeter single-handedly.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
If you have a VA claim that was denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for veterans' claims and will help you get a proper review.
For all you boating enthusiasts out there, now it's getting to be that time of year, and I want you to make sure that you give my friend Ray Schrader a call at Schrader Yacht Sales in Point Pleasant, New Jersey, our national sponsor here. Give Ray a call at 732-899-8010. Did you know, I bet you didn't know this, the first Chris Craft was built in 1874, and today that tradition continues. Wherever you go, it is a boat that is a destination in itself. Designed without compromise, it is exhilaration taken to the extreme. Whichever model you choose, each one will catch the eye, steal the heart, and fill your lungs with healthy outdoor air. Come into Schrader Yacht Sales to experience all of this for yourself. So give Ray a call again at 732-899-8010, and he promises he'll come all the way to Michigan if you need him to deliver his boats. That's Schrader Yacht Sales at SchraderYachts.com. SchraderYachts.com. Need any home repairs? Pat the Handyman is a licensed and insured remodeler who served in the United States Army. He can paint your home, install a kitchen, or finish those repairs you started and somehow never quite finished. So call Pat the Handyman at 734-260-1158 and tell him you heard about him on Veterans Radio.
Len Pitlack, CPA, is an award-winning consultant for the U.S. Small Business Development Center. Let him use his 25 years' experience to bring you, as an individual or small business owner, his professional and courteous tax and accounting services. Give Len Pitlack a call today at 734-993-1313. And we're back on Veterans Radio, coming from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Joining us today on Veterans Radio is the author of Eisenhower, a new biography in the Great General series. That's John Wukovitz. And also we've got Dan Hall, the director of the Dwight D. Eisenhower Library and Museum in Abilene, Kansas. And in the studio is Bob Gould, my partner. And we'll introduce the rest of the folks as we get toward the top of the hour. But I wanted to... Now that we've just gotten into World War II, which, of course, we all know is Eisenhower's finest hour, to take away something from Churchill. And so, Dan, I'm going to ask you a little bit. We mentioned a little bit about how he got involved, where he was at the beginning of World War II.
Well, like I said quickly a minute ago, he was at Fort Sam Houston. And actually, he was coaching two football teams, too, at the same time, one in an academy and one in high school. And then he, if you want me to repeat that about the speech, but he is called to the War Office, War Department, right after Pearl Harbor. And the speech I referred to earlier, he never was able to give. And we actually checked with Kelly Field to see if somebody else gave it, and they didn't. I think if anybody wants to read the real Eisenhower, you've got to read that speech.
And they could access that how?
I think we now have it online, but it's in the book on Eisenhower's pre-war diaries and papers. Remarkably, we have both speeches, the one he drafted in November, which is the ordinary thing to the Kelly Field cadets. You're the young officers and you're getting ready to go. But then after the war starts and he rewrites it, I mean, he's talking about, you know, the duty of the young officer is his very soul of existence. This is a remarkable, remarkable statement that he writes in his speech.
I think it's could you give out the website for the library?
Just go on and put in Eisenhower.gov.
Okay.
And it'll come up.
Okay.
I believe that's one of the speeches they put on there recently. That and the more famous In Case of Failure note after D-Day.
Well, I'm looking at your notes here. As I've got your, you know, Eisenhower, the pre-war diaries that was published for John Hopkins. Is that available at Amazon?
I think you can get it through Amazon. Yeah.
Okay, you can also get John Wukovitz's book Eisenhower through Amazon and all the rest of the books that he has written. So let me go back to John for a moment here. John, tell me what happened next with Eisenhower.
Well, he right after the war started, he then did some work in planning operations around the world, trying to get some equipment.